Hey, everybody, and welcome to this inaugural podcast. I'm Dan Trotencheck, and you are listening to Taking Care of Business Podcast. So welcome, everybody. Welcome to this series. This is something we're really kind of excited about here at NRHA. Anybody that knows me knows that I like to talk, and so this is an opportunity for me to talk and kind of have it mean something, hopefully. To give you guys a little bit of an idea of what to expect as we go forward in the podcast, the whole concept behind my podcast, at least, is I get the opportunity so often to talk to and interact with people in the industry that are just so knowledgeable about retail, so knowledgeable about consumer behavior, about what's going on in the industry, and just, quite frankly, interesting people. And I thought this podcast would be a great way to bring some of those conversations out of the aisles at a show or out of a cocktail reception, and try and get them out to the industry at large, so you can kind of hear some of the topics that these people who are knowledgeable about the industry and the goings on, kind of hear what they have to say and get some of their opinions. So we look forward to talking to some of these movers and shakers, if you will, as we go forward in the podcast. And if there was ever a guy who is dialed into the industry, it's the guy that I wanted to have be my guest on my inaugural podcast. And if you've ever been to a wholesale show or a conference or an industry event, you have likely heard the name Jim Robish. He is probably one of the most prolific speakers in the industry. Jim and I have known each other for pretty close to 25 years, but Jim has been in the industry actually a lot longer than I have, and I like to point that out just to make sure people know that Jim's older than me. But Jim has been around quite a bit, and he is currently a senior partner with the Farnsworth Group, which is probably another name that you've heard a lot kicked around in the industry for good reasons. Is the Farnsworth Group is a market research company that really specializes on the home improvement industry, and Jim has been working with Brad Farnsworth over there for quite a while. And if there was ever a guy who is dialed in and knows about retail, knows about what retailers are asking, what's going on at retail, what consumers want from retail, it's Jim Robish. Plus, Jim is a very honest fellow. Anybody that knows him knows that he will tell it to you as it is, whether you like it or not. And he's an engaging and funny guy. And so if you've ever heard him speak, you know that he is has a gift for speech and likes to talk, kind of like myself. So no better person to start our podcast series than Jim Robish. So I look forward to getting into our conversation with Jim. And I have a feeling as we go forward in these podcasts that Jim might be one of those guys that just ends up making a recurring appearance on our podcast because he's got so many opinions about so many different things. So without any further ado, let's get into our inaugural Taking Care of Business podcast with our guest today, Jim Robish. Today's episode is brought to you by Sacrete. Are you looking to add quality concrete, mortar, and stucco mixes, as well as repair and specialty items to your product lineup? Sacrete provides the tools you need to run a better business, whether that's through exceptional customer support, sales and marketing tools, varied product assortments, or just finding reliable products. Sacrete offers knowledgeable retail experts that understand the needs of your store. To learn more, visit www.sacrete.com/hardwareretailing. All right, everybody, glad to have you back here. And I am sitting here with Jim Robish, senior partner with the Farnsworth Group. Does that title still fit you well,
Jim? Nothing fits me well these days, but that is correct, Dan. Thank you.
You know, I was talking about the fact that one of the reasons I wanted to kind of start the podcast series with you is you've certainly been around the industry for a while and had a chance to see things from the seamy underbelly of the industry, and part of the idea of the podcast in general was to get a chance to sit down and talk to people just about their impressions of what's going on in the industry and where it's going and that kind of stuff. And I thought, what better guy to start with that could give us an honest, unvarnished opinion of the home improvement industry and give a little perspective. You know, I've known this, but probably not a lot of other people who are relatively new to the industry might not know that years ago, you and Brad both worked with NRHA until you kind of went your own
correct.
Way. And
my first day at NRHA was April 18th, 1978, working for Mr. Bradley T. Farnsworth.
How old were you when you started?
I'll pass on that one.
All right. Well, I'll ask you a different question. You're around it. I mean, you've been NRHA adjacent probably ever since you did work here. What do you think? What are some of the differences you see at NRHA today? How's this little organization different from when you were roaming its halls on a regular basis?
Well, I think it's hard for a lot of people to visualize an entity that was comprised of, I think we had 35 state and regional associations at that time, and there were an awful lot of cooks cooking that soup, and it was big, it was powerful. We had not seen the proliferation of warehouse home centers at that time, so the independent was the power broker in the industry, and NRHA served him extremely well. I think, don't want to get you guys big-headed around here or anything, but one of the
things, that's all right. Go ahead.
One of the things that we've seen happen is that you've been able, not that NRHA hasn't had some ups and downs, but certainly in recent times, management has at least recognized what the challenges are, and I think addressed them quite well. You're back to your roots. I mean, we're downtown.
Right.
You know, kind of been all over town and, you know, back downtown, and a cool place to work from for sure.
Yeah. I hear all the stories kind of about the industry from the old days, and the industry was kind of like, I started in the industry in the mid 90s. So my roots certainly don't go as deep as yours do in the industry, but it must have been kind of exciting to be part of the industry, one, when the independent was kind of the T-Rex of the industry, but also then to really watch what seemed like this rise of the industry with the whole DIY movement and then the big boxes emerging. It was kind of like this rocket ship taking off, and it must have been kind of exciting to see in the 80s and late 80s, early 90s, that kind of movement in the industry.
Was.
Tell us a little bit about that.
It was when you have people looking such as Lowe's and Home Depot and looking at it and seeing the tremendous growth that they had, and all of a sudden it caught Wall Street's eyes. The investment community was spot on. We got to jump on this rocket ship for sure. And the whole DIY movement, literally, it created itself. I mean, the more people did, the more they wanted to. It was like a big snowball. And one of the good things, and I think NRHA played a big role in this, it allowed people to service those, I'd call them higher level needs that were coming in when people said, well, I just repaired my faucet. I think
right.
I'm going to redo my bathroom now. Where did the independent go for education programs for their kids, the kids working in their stores? And I mean, I remember taking the advanced course in hardware retailing. Now I got it 100 on it, but I took it open book because I was at my desk.
Yeah.
But, it was the standard for sure. And all the other stuff that NRHA had put together. And a lot of that was just the result of this huge momentum that got behind the DIY for sure.
Well, even when I started at NRHA, it's interesting because back then in the mid 90s, organizations like Menards and Home Depot still actually utilized NRHA services. I mean,
they
were still kind of, while they had grown in proportion, they were still relatively, within that sphere of an organization that would still seek to use our services. And so they grew from regional organizations. And back then, the thing that struck me was the amount of home centers, these other kind of regional home center chains that were everywhere. And one of the things we always talk about when we'll hear from a reporter, or when we talk a little bit, asked to talk a little bit about the history of the industry, is, you know, well, who did Home Depot do the most damage to as those big boxes were raising up? And we always talk about, you know, one thing is you don't see these regional, kind of public home center chains that were around back then. That was kind of one of the biggest things that struck me that went away during the rise of the boxes. What about you? What do you think?
Yeah, that is an extremely accurate history of what happened. You know, you'd think of people like Payless Cashway,
sure.
Channel,
yeah.
Heckinger,
HQ,
absolutely. Builders Square.
Builders Square, yeah.
Couldn't even do it with, you know, the backing of Kmart. But I think one of the things that caused that was there seemed to be this thought, and it was a Brad Farnsworth thought, and he phrased it, they're not big enough to be big, and they can't compete at their existing size.
Right.
They're too big to be small. So they're not as nimble as the independent was. And then as well, they could not control the management, whatever they were going to do, as quickly as, say, a five-unit chain of hardware stores could. So I think response time was some of it. You saw, Depot and Lowe's just took off. Bernie and Arthur were merchants.
Right.
You go down and remember the people at Lowe's, too. And, they started with a 12,000-square-foot store, and then they doubled it. Then they thought, well, this is too small. Then it went to 36, and then there was RSVP 2 and 3 and 4 and whatever it was, to where they finalized what their, optimal model was, I guess. In that process, those people went away. Now, what was interesting, when I say people, those stores went away. A lot of the people never went away. They just changed partners. A lot of them are still in the industry today, which is, I think, the basis for a lot of the solid programs, because they really understand what DIY is all about. And they're open, to the technological changes that are coming into play now. When it comes to picking product and this is what you need and nuts and bolts and hammers and screwdrivers, that knowledge base is still there.
Well, of course,
there was that book from NRHA called the Product Knowledge Handbook.
Right. Yeah.
it still sits on my desk.
It's amazing.
Makes me look smart every once in a while.
When you look back and that NRHA has been around for some close to 120 years and, you'll look back at some of the materials we used to produce. I mean, certainly when you guys were here, but even before that, and they still, I mean, to a certain degree, have a whole lot of relevance today. I mean, I found somewhere tucked away in a back cabinet, there was a 3-ring binder that was basically a general operations manager or manual for running a hardware store. And so I just started flipping through it, and a lot of it, 90% of it, you could hand to someone running a store today and they would get something out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, you unlock the door, you walk in,
right.
You find the cash.
You have to be nice to customers.
I remember that.
Yeah, those kind of things.
I think, too, one of the best that NRHA has, and hopefully will always have, is the cost of doing business survey.
Right.
And it always amazes me how people like to take shots at, well, my store's not like that. If you dig into why their store's not like that, usually they're not in the high performance numbers.
Sure.
But,
yeah.
That's the standard of the industry. And you can always find somebody that's outside that norm. But what do you measure by? You got to be able to measure against something else. And, I was talking before about how things had evolved here. It used to just be hardware stores, lumber companies, and home centers.
Yeah.
We didn't have high profit. Well, we did have high profit stores, but we didn't have this many chains or this volume or this many people. All those breakouts are there now, so you can pretty much go in there and get a good sample of comparisons. Every accountant wants it.
Yeah.
Anybody that wants a value of business wants it.
Well, we've actually been asked to talk a lot recently about CODB. It's almost like and CODB is one of the many, many acronyms we use around here for cost of doing business.
I think that was number two, and we're on, 437 now?
Yeah, right. And one of the things that I always say when I lead off a speech when I'm talking about cost of doing business is that without having something like that, it's like going to the doctor and having them tell you, well, your blood pressure is 220 over 190. Unless you understand what that means and you understand, well, what is it like for other people? You have, and I'm not saying yours is, Jim, I don't know your blood pressure.
You're looking right at me. I don't know.
But without having something to compare it to, you really don't know how your business is doing. So yeah, I don't know that it's, no one is ever going to look at cost of doing business and saying, yeah, I'm right in line with all this stuff. But it is certainly valuable to have that tool to say, well, this gives me a range that I know where I should be and what I can be shooting for.
The other thing about that is if you think back, say when you got in, there weren't a lot of dealer roundtables.
Right.
There, you know, we had a forum here at NRHA, obviously, and you've carried that forward. But now there's an awful lot of roundtables of people who get together and they share that, and they have somebody tabulate amongst their peers so they get a better comparison. Well, heck, that would have never happened if there hadn't been a CODB to start with.
Well, and don't you think that it's kind of interesting because back in the days when you say there weren't a lot of roundtables, we look at the industry today and it seems like, occasionally it can seem very siloed. But back then, it was very much my competitor is the other independent guy. And now it certainly seems like the independent side of retail has crystallized that. And much more willing to say, I'm not competing against the other independent guys in town. In most cases, my competition is Home Depot. My competition is Amazon. My competition is Dollar General. And so they seem much more willing today to gather in, we always call it non-denominational groups, where you get everybody that flies every flag together that's willing to talk and share ideas.
It's funny you say that because NRHA hosted all the distributors, all the co-ops, which, isn't something that happens a lot now, but they were very supportive of the association then. And it was right as the Home Depot had opened stores down in New Orleans. And I don't know if you remember a group of stores called Harry's Ace Hardware.
Sure.
And we all got together and, what are we going to do about this as an industry? And for the sake of the independent, and kind of got off track a little bit. And Dan Cotter stands up and he says, "Stop it. We're not our enemies. They're our enemies."
Right.
And that mindset all of a sudden, I think, took hold because people started then, okay, well, what are you doing? And I think it gave an opportunity for NRHA to be the the Switzerland to the group, if you would.
Yeah, and that's kind of how we position ourselves today, is that
absolutely,
whatever flag you fly, you have a home at NRHA. But I also remember, though, when it was, as the big boxes began taking hold, you probably famously remember a executive from one of the large big box chains stood up on a very large stage in the industry and said, if you're an independent trying to compete against a big, the big box chains, it's like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. And I mean, that was kind of the shot across the bow for independents when it really looked like, one of the many times when it looked like independent retailers could be, circling the bowl.
They could be going away. I also remember at that same situation in that town, at that convention, he said, "You're going to be around. You can't do poorly what we do well."
Right.
"But there's so much that the independent can do that we just can't."
Right.
"So there's always going to be room for everybody."
Yeah. And I think that it's why, perhaps fellows who have you certainly have more time in the industry than I do, but you can maybe lend a little perspective.
Why do you have to keep reminding me of that?
Well, people can't see us, so it's probably a good thing.
Thank God.
Yeah, right. We both have a voice or a face for radio. With folks that have at least had kind of a little bit of time in the industry, it's now obviously the enemy at the gates, if you will, is online competition, is Amazon. And so you and me together have spoken about this new threat to retail and specifically to independent retail. But in keeping it in perspective, there have been plenty of threats. That was my alarm going off. plenty of threats to independent retailers throughout the years. And I think that that ability to be nimble and that flexibility have really kind of allowed independent retailers to respond. Is there anything you see different with the emergence of the online threat that should be taken a little bit differently than some of the other threats retailers and retail have seen in the past.
Yeah, it's amazing. You never know what the next rude awakening will be. We think about farm stores weren't a threat. Well, you've got Tractor Supply. Walmart was a group of small little discount stores. Now they're massive, just massive. The one thing that Amazon has done, besides if you ever want to have anybody show up for your seminar, just call Amazon something. We found that out, right? But there's now people that are much more aware in a profound way about the importance of their pricing. Yeah. And with price transparency out there, we still have so many folks that we work with that are of the opinion, well, my prices are okay and I'll be fine. Well, maybe you will, maybe you won't, but if your prices could be better, you're going to have an edge that other people don't. But this whole price awareness and how you approach pricing, if you look at the transformation now too, of buy online, pick up in store, that's filtering down through the independent ranks in numerous formats. They're realizing that one thing that we've tried, and obviously we're in consumer research and research folks, that when you listen to what your customers are saying, or more importantly, when you find out what they're doing, maybe why they're not shopping with you, and you can respond to that, 9 times out of 10, you're going to be at least somewhat successful. Right. And, with the information that's out there, I think it was Amazon has been a catalyst to get people to, whoa, wait a minute, let's step outside this traditional box that got us here for 50 years, and what do we have to do now? For a lot of them, it's just to recover lost share. Some of it's to maintain a dominant position that they had. But there's some folks out there that, and we know them, they come to our conferences and stuff, that are really kicking some big time butt with the way they operate now, which is some instances 180 degrees from what it was as recently as 10 years ago.
Right. We're gonna take a break from our interview for just 1 second to get a quick message from one of our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by Flexon. Flexon water hoses have been the choice of home gardeners and professional landscapers for over 60 years. Based right here in the U.S., Flexon offers a wide selection of hoses. Whether your customer is maintaining their home lawn and garden, or they're working with a complex professional landscape. Whether you need a flexible, lightweight hose, a drinking water safe hose, or a heavy-duty hose with the latest non-kink technology, Flexon has the right hose for you. Visit FlexonHose.com today to learn more about what Flexon can do for you. You work with a lot of retailers and have worked with a lot of retailers throughout the years, helping them figure out how to expand their business, helping them figure out what's going wrong and what's going right, what consumers perceive of their businesses and contractors perceive of their businesses. I could certainly share mine. What do you think throughout all those experiences, what is your biggest frustration when you're working with retailers about, if you could just get this one thing or break through this one thing, your business would have a much better opportunity to grow, not even talk about survival, but opportunity to grow. What do you see as that biggest frustration that is kind of a common thread through a lot of the retailers you work with?
Probably two, Dan. The first one is, and people will disagree with this because you and I know there's no egos in this industry, but a lot of people...
I thought you were going to say in this room.
Well, there's none in here, right? Yeah. No, a lot of the people we work with are, for some reason, they have this mindset that I own a company, I manage a company, I manage the marketing, whatever function they're doing, and I'm supposed to know what to do, so I do stuff without asking that classic question, what's it have to do with what my customers want? And I've seen, regardless of the flag people are flying, regardless of the size of the store, time and time again, the people who recognize, whoops, I got a different customer here, that wants different things, and I can respond to that. That's how they're continuing to be successful. But to see it is one thing. I mean, we can give her reams of data and say, here's where you are, this is what you should be doing, all that. But to get them to actually take action is probably the most difficult thing.
Yeah.
And if it in any way, shape, or form is, I don't think that's makes them uncomfortable. There's a lot more uncomfortable people today. Two things happen. One, either they just put the book on the shelf and go on their merry way, or they're like, it's the catalyst to get them to do something.
Yeah. And I know that one of the areas even more specific to me that I see a lot of times is this getting entrenched in the ideas of, well, this is the way that we've done it, and you're going to really have to prove to us that it needs to be changed. And one of the most common that I see is this concept of this dated concept that just seems to be prevalent with so many retailers of customer service. You know, and it's one of the soapboxes I always climb on when I'm pontificating from whatever platform I'm given, is that customer service is so different today than it was 5 years ago. And you know, I'll use the stories about, you know, do you provide peer reviews the way Amazon does? Well, that's service, folks. Can you deliver a product to someone's house within 2 hours? Well, that's service, folks. And that's what today's customers view as service. And it's not to direct compare between brick and mortar and an online store, but it's just this whole concept of today's consumers, the millennials of today and the Gen Z of today are being raised on this different concept.
Well, yeah, they're getting information in real time.
Yeah.
And that is a problem for a lot of people because they're not at that level yet. But I think what's, you asked me, you know, what do I see that's frustrating to me? I'll revisit that here real quickly. They're not as strong at service as they used to be. And not only that, Lowe's, Depot, and Menards get some pretty darn good service ratings.
Well, right. It always
and they'll
seems
sit there and go,
be...
no, they don't have any service. Well, excuse me, that's not what their customers are saying to us.
Yeah, it seems to be. Now, part of that could certainly be because customers have changed their service expectations. But it seems that a lot of times you do get that, well, I am immediately going to dismiss the big boxes as they provide crap customer service.
Yeah.
And that's
there, and
not.
There's one more. And they're not as conveniently located as me.
Right.
And that's wrong, too.
Right. I mean, I know it's the case for me. I would have to drive by at least two big boxes to get to the local retailer that services my market.
And three coffee houses, a couple of liquor stores. You'll never make
I'll never make it.
That's
yeah.
Right.
God, if there's a donut shop along the way, which there is, we're in trouble. But so no, it's certainly a point well taken. And you know, I was having an interesting conversation. We have a lot of really bright young people that work here at NRHA. And a while back, we were talking about customer service. And one of the things that came up was, you know, some of the people were expressing, you know, I hate going in a store when someone hovers next to me and won't release me from their customer service grip, you know. But for so many people, probably in our demographic, that idea of, no, I'm going to be your personal servant as I'm walking you around the store has just changed so much. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I forget what they call it these days, but it's, what is it, accessible service, not, you know, where the help is nearby, but it's not hovering over you, you know.
Well, we did a study, it's been a couple of years ago. And one of the things we found out in terms of service typologies was that half of them require absolutely no human interaction.
Yeah.
And if, you know, you used to always say, well, I'm going to remodel my store so I can get my 35% sales increase. And we come in with colors and signs and all this stuff. Okay. Now you've got to be thinking about not just the aesthetics of your store, but how is it functioning as a service part of your team? You know, is it easily self-shopped? You know, is your wayfaring signage in place? my gosh, do you even have sub-department categories listed? So somebody comes in, the line of sight hits them, and like, oh, okay, there's under faucet repair right there. I'm under sink repair, excuse me. I've got to go to that aisle and get my products. So I think the next generation's coming up, and especially I think, too, even with the older generations, those guys that are older than me, you know, they're catching on too. You know, I don't want somebody hovering over me that doesn't know what they're talking about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it really, I didn't come into working at NRHA with a love of data, but I certainly throughout my time here have really embraced looking at numbers and seeing the kind of story that numbers could tell. And that's obviously what the business you're in. But, you know, a study that we worked on 15 years ago together, we worked on just a couple years ago together, that underscores the point you're talking about, is the merchandising for profit study.
Absolutely.
And it's amazing to me when you look one thing, you know, there's more dazzling statistics when you look at disposable dump bins and so on. But when you look at the sales lift that can be created just by putting feature benefit signage with an item in aisle, it's just amazing, you know, and it
makes you wonder how many actually have any signs up at all.
Right. Yeah. And just something that calls out the features and benefits of products that creates a lift that, like you see, it really is testament to the thought process that goes into it. And I think that to what you're saying with the access to information that consumers have now, they're going to want more of that. I mean, right now you look at a product, you get other suggestions alongside of it, you get reviews right there with it. And so don't you think that as brick and mortar figures out how to deal with the way consumers are changing because of the online options, that taking the best from what's happening online and figuring out how to kind of more closely replicate that in the stores is going to be a big part of it?
I think so. Customers today, they're hyper-educated. They come in armed with more information, which is kind of a good thing for some people because they got so much they get confused too. So, but they know so much more than they used to. And, you know, we all used to say, oh, well, the path to purchase doesn't really necessarily start online all the time. Pert near it does.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, unless you need a plunger, maybe you don't go online to look for a plunger because the water's flowing over, but it does. And, you know, they probably, I was with a group about 35 stores last week, and we were talking about they probably know more, the customers do, than most of the staff over the stores.
Well, we just had a conversation about that, and you know, one of the things that's come up in some of the reports that I've looked at is the hesitance for some retailers to put mobile devices or allow mobile devices on the floor. And you know, the feedback you consistently see and the numbers you see and the consumer data you see is that, man, you're just depriving your sales team of a tool that your customers have at their disposal.
Yeah, the customer's standing there with it right there.
But you're so worried they're going to be texting their girlfriend during the shift that you won't let them have their mobile, you know, but
well, that'll still happen.
Yeah, well, that'll happen, believe me. It'll happen one way or another. But it's certainly heading into and coming into some interesting times here. What do you think, what are some of the things you guys are looking at right now at Farnsworth? What are some of the interesting things you guys have going on?
Well, a couple things, and, you know, we've got several business units that we work with. We do a lot of work with manufacturers, and then we do industry work with like distributors and associations, mm-hmm. and stuff, and then we got the retail side. And the retail side kind of falls into two. We've got the, you know, we work with the big boys, but, you know, we also work with a lot of independents. And I'll keep it down at the independent level because I think that's what's important. The biggest thing that independents are trying to figure out today is how can they make their advertising more effective? And, you know, you can call it reaching out, you can call it communicating with your core customers. I don't care what you call it. It goes back to, you know, what media do we use? What message do we send? What do they think? Are they getting it? Everybody thinks because newspaper subscriptions are way down that people don't read the paper. Well, you know, I can pull 10 markets we did last year where the second highest advertising use was in the local newspaper. So sometimes national studies can be deceiving, eh?
Yeah.
I think that's one of the biggest ones. The other thing is, with technology out there, how can they be at least keeping up? And you and I have gone to a couple conferences on this, and I think you're spot on there, Dan, because you don't have to do what Depot's doing because you don't have the $1 billion to spend on it. But you can sure as heck get closer than you do. And where does that come from? And it goes back to that when we're helping them, you know, let's make it simple. You want to develop a strategy? Here's five things, not 35 things.
Right, yeah.
And what are the five things that are most important? And I bet 80% of our studies, communication and advertising is in the top three.
Yeah, and you know, I know some of the research that we looked at together about what's important to consumers with that online interaction.
Oh, yeah.
Some of that stuff, you know, sure, it would be great if you're an independent, you're able to offer this level of sophistication that you see at some of the e-commerce sites, but that's not necessarily what the customers are looking for. The customers are looking for things that in most cases, even retailers on a relatively limited kind of budget could deliver with a little bit of thought, and if they know some, you know, 22-year-old kid who could do a little bit of web work for them.
We're going around a circle here. If they would give up on that thing that they won't get off that isn't important anymore and invest in the things that are,
right? Yeah,
they could afford it.
What do you think, you know, talking about independence and talking about running businesses, and this is kind of something else that I've had a lot of conversations lately. You're a numbers guy. What do you think are some of the most important numbers that a retailer should look at that they typically don't look at?
Well, the first one I think you continually have to look at is your transaction size.
Yeah.
If you can't attract new customers, when you got your existing customers in the store, you've got to be maximizing what you're selling to them. And, you know, Brad makes a comment a lot, which I think is so appropriate. You know, what's a bottle of Gatorade cost? You know, $1.99 or something? Well, for their transaction size, for some people, you just raised it.
Yeah.
You know, 5%. The other one is the whole gross margin balance of price image and not giving away. You know, we tell people you've got a challenging price image. Okay, well, so many people just want to go start dropping prices. Well, what's that do to your margin? You still have to run the business, right? Trying to balance that and. Where do they go to get the information to do that? I think that's another big issue that we try and help them with. The whole issue of advertising, reaching out to the new customers. You know, we live around this and people listen to this will say, oh my God, here he goes again on the revenue equation. But that's all there is. There's only three things you can control.
Yeah.
Traffic, closure, and transaction size.
Yeah.
I think conversion's big too, but I'd much rather be selling people the low-hanging fruit or the people that are coming to me now. Let's get them in more frequently and let's sell them more when we got them in there.
I was talking about this with a couple of folks last week, and there was some research done that seems to show that the average transaction in hardware stores, if you say it's I don't care, $22, $24, whatever it might be per transaction, that there are fewer low ticket items that contribute to that transaction. So they're not selling a lot of those $1, $2, $3 items as part of that transaction. It's a little bit higher ticket. And the theory behind it was that a lot of those sales are going to discounters or going to the Dollar General stores and so on. So maybe it's time to do exactly what you're thinking. And what are some of that low hanging fruit that you can just add on to a transaction? It's amazing to me when you talk to some of these retailers, particularly people that do it really well, seem to be the farm retailers that sell things like bagged candy And was talking to one here, or saw a presentation from a farm retailer lately that said it is one of our biggest add-on and highest gross margin categories bagged candy. And, well, you, and they're selling and that stuff with like 70% of their sales.
Those pink plastic pigs, when you squeeze them, it sounds like they're farting, you know? That ain't a low margin item because he doesn't take any low margins. No, you're right. The small, I think you've got to relate to that small item in the dollar stores. Go back and drive, or go out and drive through a small town, and you go past the building that used to be the hardware store, and now you got Dollar General, maybe two or three, you know, the dollar type stores. They're replacing in the small markets because they have a broader mix. They've got many grocery stores, you know, they've got clothing, they got pretty much anything you'd need. But I think you're right. A lot of that stuff, you know, if I need tape, if I need a tool, if I need some nuts, I need some bolts, some nails, screws, whatever it is, I'm going to go to Dollar General because I'm going there anyway.
Right. Yeah. And cleaning supplies, things like that, that a lot of times end up being made as part of that Saturday purchase at the hardware store are ending up going other places. So Jim, 15 years from now, when you're shuffling around, getting ready to go to the National Hardware Show, what do you think the industry is going to...
When somebody's pushing me around?
when I'm pushing you into the National Hardware Show, what do you think the industry is going to look like? What kind of place do you see for independents? How do you see the boxes evolving? I mean, look into your crystal ball here for a second and what do you see?
I can't help.
Do you see yourself rolling into the hardware show in 15 years from now?
I'm thinking 5 years from now. I can't help but think that there will always be some form of the hardware store. Okay, the naysayers of, you know, brick and mortar is going away, and then what happens? Amazon starts opening stores. So let's throw that, you know, that assumption out the window. But what you're going to see, I think, is, in many instances, a smaller box for the hardware stores, right, but so much of it being done online and probably delivered.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be commonplace. Will we be there in 5 years? I don't know. You know, we're always a little, independents always a little slow to make things happen because there's nobody pounding them and saying you have to do this until the market dictates that they have to do it. And even then, sometimes I don't think they listen to it. I think if you want to know what's going on, we'll move to the home improvement warehouses. They give the best hints of all. And they give good hints because they've got the investment community.
Sure.
And they have to let the investment community know where their billions of dollars are going to be in 5 and 10 years. 15 years, Dan, I have no idea.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to have hovercrafts. And, I can't wait to be sitting on the front porch and have a drone bring me something from the liquor store. I mean, from the hardware store. Gosh, that was Freudian. They're investing so heavily. And it's in the, if you look at the distribution side, it's the distribution to their customers.
Right.
You know, how do we, you know, I was flying into Houston the other day and I look and there had to be 400 Amazon trailers down there. I mean, it's, like you said, it's a different ballgame. It's totally different. And I don't know if a lot of people just don't want to recognize that. Kind of the same way they didn't want to recognize that, you know, home improvement warehouses were a threat.
Right.
You know, they used to say, oh, they're too big. Nobody wants to walk around that much. That was wrong, too. Now we got thousands and thousands of them. So, but I think there will always be the place for the hardware store. But you mentioned service, too. The service aspect of it, the distribution aspect of it, I think will change dramatically. And how the individual operators approach the service aspect. The old response of more people, probably not, you know. Now we noticed there's been some futile efforts at trying to use robotics in our stores. And that store is not around anymore. But it's interesting that they're trying it and somebody's gonna get it right.
Yeah.
And, you know, will, you know, the next generations coming up expect that? Well, I mean, yeah, they will.
I mean, it's not to sound like, you know, your typical old guy, but who would have thought 5 years ago, or certainly 10 years ago, that we'd have devices in our home that we talk to and could order products from and that listen to us. I mean, that was Jetsons kind of stuff. And who would have thought that? A little while back, I wrote a column about, I remember the first ATM machine and how blown away I was that, oh, you put a card in there and it gives you cash, you know, and now, well, ATM machines are hardly anybody carries cash anymore. So it's not even worthy of bringing up.
Well, remember the old parking lot attendant?
Yeah.
Now
sure.
You put the card in. Yeah.
Yeah,
well, you do all the work.
Yeah.
And put it on the windshield. Yeah.
Or I saw something the other day. It was a picture of a line of what used to be where payphones were, but now just the dividers, and said, you know, you had to be born before X year to even know what this was, you know, and that's certainly the case. But anything coming up, Farnsworth, you want to plug? Anything you guys have going on or studies you have coming out? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the big things that I think is important is, you know, we took over the management again of the Home Improvement Research Institute, which started here at NRHA,
right.
With Brad managing it back then. And that is a tremendous organization.
A great organization, yeah.
Yeah, and what's so great about that is you've got a great mix of whether it be independent distribution, the co-ops, what have you, the key manufacturers, the key large retailers, getting together to get research, thinking about exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Let's not, you know, ready, fire, aim. Let's look at the issues and see what they are. So it's fun doing that again. That's probably one of the biggest things. We continue to grow. That's always something.
And that's at HIRI.org. If someone wants to check out HIRI, another acronym, HIRI, but Home Improvement Research Institute.
Yeah.
So if someone wants to check that out, it's definitely worthwhile. I mean, we get calls all the time from just about every part of the channel looking for, do you have information on this? Do you have information on this? And we find ourselves pointing people towards HIRI a lot. So if you're out there and you're looking for an organization that can provide you with for a range of data for a really affordable price, when you consider the amount of data you get your hands on for it, it's really worthwhile to check that out.
I think the other thing is we stuck Brad Farnsworth in a room again and tell him to start thinking. And we're toying with, you know, a lot of people are still fascinated with generations, and you know, what is it really? Because we look at generations, and you know, well, the millennials are different. Well, then they buy a house, and they're not different at all,
right?
And they're a little different, okay. But what is it that allows you to segment the consumer today and target them differently now that we have technological tools that we can do that? So if we know it might be somebody that's a certain age, but you know, or the old idea of, you know, city folks, rural, urban, suburban, you know, millennials, Gen Xers, we're kind of stepping back and saying, what really matters in terms of segmentation? And so we'll be playing around with that.
Okay.
Well, happy to see where that goes.
It's always a hot topic, and the conversation more often than not when I run into circles is how the millennials are ruining everything. And it's interesting being a parent of at least one millennial. It's you know, at the end of the day, it seems like everybody wants the same things, maybe just at different times and in different fashions. But they're, you know, it's really not as different as everybody likes to paint it.
The criticisms of the millennials is nothing more than they were an easy target.
Sure.
And, you know, I can remember when I'm not a millennial, but when I was the age of the millennial, I acted the same way.
Absolutely. We so, were ruining the world back then.
We sure were.
Yeah.
How could they do that, you know?
So. Well, hey, Jim, I always enjoy sitting down and talking with you. I appreciate you coming
pleasure.
By.
And, you know, it's always
it's
an
interesting.
Honor,
I know we're both headed off into market season here, and we're going to make our rounds to all the distributor shows. So maybe we can get back together and chat once again after we make it through the market season and talk about what are all the new and exciting things that we didn't even get to touch on what's going on at distribution or manufacturing. So that could certainly be a whole other show.
Why is that on the wall with an X through it? We can't talk about
and I think we made it through the whole thing without any cursing or without Kevin having to bleep anything out. So we'll see if we can change
you
that.
You can teach
too.
Old dogs new tricks.
Well, hey, Jim, thanks.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much, Jim.
Today's episode is brought to you by Kohl's Wild Bird. With Kohl's line of top quality birding products, your customers get what they paid for, more wild birds on the bird feeder. Launched from the family garage over 35 years ago, Kohl's Wild Bird Products is a true mom and pop success dedicated to making your store the place for birders to shop again and again. Kohl's believes that birds are like people. Give them what they like to eat and they'll come back and bring their friends. After all, if you just want bird seed, buy any brand. If you want birds, buy Kohl's.